Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Today we're re-airing the very first episode of Southbound, which we put into the world on November 15th, 2017. Our guest for that first episode was Harvey Gantt, a longtime pioneer in civil rights in the Carolinas. Gantt was involved in sit-ins as a high school student. He was the first black student at Clemson, then the first black mayor of Charlotte. He made two runs at Jesse Helms' seat in the U.S. Senate, narrowly losing both times. As I listened back to our conversation from 2.5 years ago, it was easy to hear the echoes of the upheaval we're going through now. Harvey Gantt has seen and heard it before, and he has learned how to survive and succeed. Here's our conversation. And when did you feel like you needed to do something yourself?
There never was an instinct of activism in those years that we quarried our father and read as much as we could about attitudes in the South at that time. It was almost like, well, that's happening, but there really is nothing for me to do. We'd hear occasionally about a court case or some brave soul like Authorine Lucy, who went to the University of Alabama back in 1955. It's amazing, I still remember that. And, you know, thought about how brave she was, but it never translated to me. It is when we met a young lawyer like Matthew Perry, who would come to some of these occasional mass meetings or NAACP meetings in Charleston, interestingly enough, at the Emmanuel Church.
Where the Dillon Roof?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's the church that we all went to. That's where I met Matthew Perry. And we were fascinated by this very youthful lawyer who kept talking about changes that were going to occur, and he started to bring it down to where they were going to occur and why things like this would happen. And this was, you know, you gotta sort of remember the times. You started to see on the news reports in the evenings stuff happening all over. You started to look at, prior to 54, much of the civil rights activity was in the courtrooms, right? I mean, you had somebody who filed a lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. But it really wasn't on the consciousness of the American people at all. After Martin Luther King, it changed. And then after the sit-ins, it changed even more. And it was the sit-ins of Greensboro that captured the imagination of classmates of mine, because by then I was now in high school. We were seniors in high school, and we were graduating in May. And these kids, Frank McCain, who lived here in Charlotte, was one of those four or five students who sat at lunchtime. We thought how imaginative that was. And now I think back on it, we were all this hell being raised about having a Coke and a hot dog at a lunch counter in a public place where we bought five and dime items all the time.
But feels crazy now, right?
Now you start thinking about how stupid this whole system was. And that's when we discovered that's the way we would get involved.
And you got involved as a high school student at a sit-in at the Cress's store in Charleston, right? Now, how did that come about? Like, how did y'all?
Well, we were inspired by the Greensboro students,
right? Tommy. And then how did y'all move toward actually doing something yourselves?
Well, first of all, we practiced.
How'd you practice?
Well, first of all, we went to the NAACP Youth Council. We were members of, so that's the core group that started, probably 35, 40 kids. And we saw what was going on nightly news. We got resources in the NAACP that told us some of the things that were a great concern. Whether you could be nonviolent, whether you could sit down and accept the insults that you were going to get. And so they told us, these advisors, to the youth council were saying to us, you can't just go out there and assume that you're going to sit down at a lunch counter. You need to know what you're going to encounter. And we do want to keep this nonviolent. We suggested you try to identify the students in your group that might be able to withstand the encounters that they were going to have. And to make a long story short, we had practice sessions in which we had one group of people acting as the antagonists, the other group of people sitting as the sit-iners, and we hurled all kinds of epithets to see how many people were provoked beyond. And we identified some students.
And I was going to say, were there students there who realized in that moment they couldn't,
that's right,
they couldn't deal with that?
We had students who said, look, our not just me. There were three leaders in the group. And they told us, you know, we think it's best we not go. Because I can't stand somebody calling me to my face the N-word or pouring ketchup on my head or some such thing as that.
So what was there in you that made you feel like you could deal with that?
I never doubted that I could do it. Maybe all those years of study and this passion, this feeling that America was going to be better than this and I'm going to be part of this change, and now I found a way to do it, and this is the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to be a part of a sit-in that's going to change Charleston. And a number of us felt that way. I wasn't the only one that felt that way. So 35 to 40 students came down to about 26 or 27. And then we didn't even tell our parents.
I was going to ask that. So did you?
No, we couldn't tell our parents. It would be crazy to tell our parents because they would be the hindrance to us ever doing it. In fact, when my mother found out that I'd done it, she was angry with me, even though my father was privately amused by it. But her first thing was, you're going to have a police record, and that's going to affect your going to college or whatever. But those are things you don't worry about. You don't think about those kinds of things.
I don't remember. Did you actually get arrested that day?
Yeah, we did. We got arrested. We sat at the lunch counter, and the manager comes out immediately, and they're obviously very prepared for this kind of potential thing. And we had already decided we would not identify a leader. We would simply sit and continue to ask one, we want a Coke and a hot dog. I want a Coke and a ginger ale. I want whatever. And they kept saying, you can't do that, which also made it seem so stupid. What do you mean you can't get this? Bottom line, though, is we sat for about 6 or 7 hours, maybe that long. It was early afternoon. We went in the morning. Early afternoon, they finally decided we were not going to identify who the leader was. We were not going to say anything more than the fact of what we wanted and that we were going to wait there until we got it. And they told us that you're trespassing, and we were taken nicely. You know, all that stuff we were expecting, all the hooting and the jeering and stuff, the Charleston police, to their credit, decided we're not going to allow that kind of thing to occur in Charleston. And so they cleared the store. They made sure that when they arrested us, no one bothered us. They didn't even take us to a jailhouse. They arrested us. They told us we were officially under arrest for trespassing. But they took us to a courtroom, and we sat there for the rest of the afternoon until our parents came to pick us up at about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening.
I'm trying to imagine that message getting around to all the sets of parents. Or did your mom and dad find out during the day as it was happening?
No, I don't ever remember telling anybody my name. But somehow... they were there, and I don't think I've ever asked them, how did you know I was a part of this group?
Right.
Someone identified every one of us, and parents were happy to see us at the end of the day. They couldn't wait to get us to the car so they could cuss us out.
Now, did it have the desired effect?
Yes, it did. I think it did. A few years later, there were more demonstrations in Charleston for public accommodations and things like that. One of the many groups across the South that caused this momentum to move toward the 64 Civil Rights Act. But we did this in 1960. We were finally cleared. We always had that charge against us, even when we went off to college, that we'd been arrested, that the case was pending in court. And it was Matthew Perry that got us off in a class action suit that said that none of these things were legitimate. And, of course, we all knew it wasn't. So Part of what I think drove us and minimized any fear that people had was that we thought we were right, which causes me to understand people who are passionate about something today. But we thought we had morality on our side. The moral compass that we were following was right, and everybody else was so wrong. I mean, anybody could see how stupid this was. And to a bunch of young kids, 16 through 18 years old, you couldn't really do a lot to cause us to be fearful of what the consequences would be.
Once you did that, and it worked, and you came out of it relatively unscathed, did that make you immediately want to do something else? I mean, did you have sort of a thirst to do that sort of thing then?
It is interesting, isn't it? People ask that question often. Is that the thing that drove you to go to Clemson? I never related the two.
Really?
Not in that sense. It wasn't as if I'm finished with this challenge, now let me go take on the next challenge. What it did say was that when you see something that needs to be corrected and it's something you're interested in doing, always believe that the rightness of the thing could cause you to move to action. Matthew Perry, that same attorney, came back and spoke to the group of us after it was all over. And he said, mentioned in one of his sentences that this is just the beginning. There are things even more substantial than getting a Coke and a hot dog at a lunch counter. You know, there's the voting issue that we have to tackle. There are all kinds of things happening across the South. Some of you might want to go to the University of South Carolina or Clemson. Matthew always in later years says that's the thing that stimulated me to want to go to Clemson.
He wanted credit for it, yes.
But at the time he said it, I didn't see myself as the one doing it. What triggered the Clemson thing, again, was this notion after spending a semester in Iowa and seeing how cold it got in the winters, that and noticing that Clemson was a decent school of architecture. What motivated me was to say, why not go there? See, that's what this whole thing, the Supreme Court decision, as we look back on it, said to a lot of young people, there are lots of possibilities that we've never explored before. So we're not going to be hindered by the fact that something says, the law says you can't go because of the color of your skin. Now, I took advantage of laws that the South had started to fabricate, or not fabricate, but put together. One of them was in fear of having schools integrated, which is probably the biggest barrier to cross for lots of Southerners. Their kids sitting in classrooms with black kids. They had decided that separate but equal would work, but it didn't quite work at the higher education level in courses that are not easy to put in place in two places. Architecture was one of those. So if, in fact, someone wanted to study architecture as a black person, they put in place a tuition grant program that said, we will pay the difference between what the in-state and out-of-state student would pay if you were going to Clemson. So I got that differential for two semesters.
So the state of South Carolina actually paid you to go to Iowa State?
They paid the difference. Since I couldn't find a school of architecture in South Carolina available to me unless I went to Clemson.
You sounded like you never had any doubts you would be okay at the sit-in. And at Cresses, whatever, did you have doubts how things might go at Clemson for you?
That's a very good question. Maybe I did. Yeah, there's a little bit of concern. And it got exacerbated even more when I saw how much resistance Clemson was putting up to my going, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees.
Right. It took, what, a year or two for you to, between the time you first applied?
Five applications.
Yeah.
Every semester available to me, summer school included, each time being rejected, finally filing a lawsuit on the fourth one, and whatever. So there was a resistance. No longer were we naive enough to believe that people were going to do the right thing. We knew this was going to be a fight. I think what gave me the greatest concern was watching in 1962, September, James Meredith going to the University of Mississippi. We had hoped to have been going to South Carolina, I mean to Clemson at that time.
Right.
Didn't happen. Judge ordered a trial. That trial was held. in October, November, and the judge ruled against us. But I watched and saw the reaction in South Carolina. On the one hand, lots of people who said, you got to resist this like Mississippi is trying to resist it. On the other hand, there were lots of very sensible people, like Governor Hollings and others, who had already said to the legislators that this thing is coming. And we will exhaust every legal remedy we've got, but it's going to happen. Well, he didn't say it like that to the state.
Right, but that's...
But I watched Matthew Perry joke with the lawyers in the cloakroom before they'd go into the courtroom, and everybody was talking about not if, but when it was going to happen. But I was still concerned that Mississippi had become just a terrible scene. People getting killed, riots, all the stuff associated. But I felt better by the time January of 63 approached, when from the college president on down, they just simply said, we're not going to tolerate that in South Carolina, which led to a statement that I made that said, you know, South Carolina is one of the original 13 colonies. You can appeal to their manners, if not to the morality of the situation. They're not going to do anything to act stupid.
Now, I remember hearing a great story from you, I think, directly, about the time you tested your security there on campus.
When I had some friends from the architecture school that faked a fight just to see how many people were watching us, was in fact this placid, very peaceful environment because there was law enforcement all around, or did they really think that Clemson was ready to just accept this and go on? So some friends of mine on our way from the architecture school one evening said, let's pretend we're going to get into an argument and a fight with you. Let's just see what happens. And we did.
And
SLED agents from everywhere. So were surrounding us. What's going on? Can we help you? You know.
Were they like plain clothes or something?
Of course.
So you didn't know day to day.
I didn't know who
there were people around.
That's part of what we were trying to figure is they looked like students. They were agents.
When we come back, Harvey Gantt talks about his battles with Senator Jesse Helms and one of the most notorious campaign ads in history. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'd like to take just a moment here to remind you of the remarkable work my colleagues at WFAE have done in one of the most trying times I can remember as a journalist. From Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, to our daily newscasts and features, to our podcasts and stories on the web, our staff has worked long and hard to bring you news about the coronavirus, and more recently, the protests locally and globally after the death of George Floyd. You can help us keep that work going with your donations. Just go to WFAE.org and hit the red donate button at the top. Thank you so much for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Harvey Gantt. So when it came time in 1990 or 89 or whatever it was, when you decided to run against Jesse Helms, what was that decision like? What was going back and forth in your mind? Was there a lot of hesitation over it? Did you jump in right away? What did that feel like?
That's another good question. I was playing tennis with Mel Watt, and after a pretty rigorous tennis match, we were sitting there drinking water or something, maybe stronger than that. And saying, isn't it interesting that Jim Hunt's not going to run against Jesse Helms? And don't you think we ought to be challenging, at least presenting another viewpoint of North Carolina, a lot of North Carolinians have, rather than assuming that we're just going to concede this race to this particular conservative senator? Maybe Mel said something about what we're going to do about it. I said, like, we're going to run against him. And I swear it's just as simple as that. He said, we're going to do it. I didn't think about all the strikes that I had against me. You don't, when you want to, back to even the sit-in thing, when you want to do something and you think there is a possibility of doing it, we are still living in America, you know, so let's go present that. Don't be burdened by the baggage of things that people have set for you. So in my case, we said, first of all, you're not a North Carolina graduate. You're not a North Carolinian. You don't have a lot of money. Jesse raises a lot of money. And you went to Clemson, trying to be elected a senator in North Carolina. And you're black. How are you going to do that? There has not been a black that's won the statewide nomination for this kind of office. So why do you want to do that? I said, I just thought Jesse needed to be challenged. I didn't know. We didn't ask ourselves whether or not we were going to win, but at least maybe another viewpoint can be expressed out there that might cause people to say, yeah, there is another way to look at how we ought to move forward as a state and a nation.
What do you feel like your positives were going into those?
My positives were that what needed to be addressed were simple kitchen table issues that people all could relate to. We were at the end of the Cold War. We had lots of things that needed to be done, not the least of them being some of the things we talk about today, jobs, health care, education, the environment, which, as you will recall, were the primary themes that I ran on. And we felt that my opponent really didn't spend a lot of time dealing with those issues at all. It was amazing how little time he spent on those. Instead, accrued his fame largely on minutia and hot-button issues that people got excited about, quotas and so forth and so on. So we said, you know, if we had a sensible discussion about these issues, perhaps we could make it an interesting race, even if we didn't win. And we didn't have any money, too. So, you know, people thought we were really kind of being crazy. You probably did. I don't know whether you wrote a column or not.
That was before my column this time. As it got closer to election day, though, obviously, you were, at least, if not winning in some polls, even in others. Did you start allowing yourself to believe I'm going to win?
I probably never said it quite like that. I kept saying, you just got to go out every day and say the same thing to every voter. Say what you believe, and you might win. Now, very few people remember, and I tell school kids this all the time, because, you know, they talk about, oh, you used to be mayor of Charlotte and you got elected twice. I said, and I lost twice, too, running for mayor. And one of the things those two losses gave me, first in a primary to Eddie Knox and then after my second term to Sue Myring, is that in politics you have to be prepared to win and lose. But it should not downgrade the message you want to deliver to voters as to why your vision of where we want to see that constituency move. So I never was paralyzed by the notion of whether I can win or lose the election, because I never would have gotten into it first place. Most people would have given me very slim odds. So in those days, in those wonderful days, and I call them wonderful days, when we were going out and meeting people in all parts of North Carolina with big crowds coming out, you started to feel, you know, just maybe enough people are listening to this vision that maybe we're going to be successful. But you didn't dwell on that too long, because if I'm driving across the state from point A to point B, we might stop in to pick up a bag of potato chips and a soda and be treated, people don't even recognize who you are, you know. So you know that this is still going to be a fight right to the last. And then Helms comes out with this genius of an ad that he had, or the hands ad, which I call the genius ad.
It's funny you call it genius ad. It's maybe evil genius. It might be one way to put it. But for people who don't know, just kind of briefly describe what it.
Well, The ad basically shows the hands of a white man who, with plaid shirt and on, you could identify as what the people would call someone who was definitely a grassroots, salt of the earth, white citizen, who is wrangling over the fact that he's not getting the job that he really wanted to get because of quotas and other kinds of things that give those jobs to minorities.
You needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota. Is that really fair? Harvey Gantt says it is.
The reason it's a genius ad, in my opinion, we had downplayed the issue of race as much as you could, and people were watching and seeing white North Carolinians being neutralized by the race we had run up to that point and saying, I'm not even going to go to the polls. To folks actually beginning to believe the message that education, healthcare, and other were really the important issues. A lot of his voters were not going to vote, and they were galvanized because now this was Jesse that they knew, and Jesse was saying that those folks are coming to take your jobs. He appealed to the fear that they had that they might be losing jobs, and they were losing jobs. Textile industry is on decline, tobacco, all these things were going down, but they weren't going down because of quotas. But he'd appeal and had that effectively done and injected a little bit of race into that, not a little bit, quite a bit of it.
Sure.
Which he could not talk about in a confrontational way with me. Might have even done more of that if Jim Hunt was running, but he couldn't with me and not end up really looking bad. But this was a way to inject it, and to inject it in the last 10 days of the campaign. And I think it turned out the voters that he needed.
Yeah, so it came out right like a week and a half before.
Yeah, it was very short.
And I remember talking to somebody one time who was with the Helms campaign who said their polls showed them several points behind before the ad came out. And then almost instantaneously,
it went the other way.
Several points. I mean, did your guys
both
do the same thing?
That's accurate.
So you felt like that was the difference, right?
And we didn't want to end the campaign talking about race. So we just simply said it was ridiculous. And it just others suggested that we might have been more frontal in our attack on racism.
Well, that's what I wonder, that, you know, there's that phrase that has come out, you know, in the last few years, you know, when they go low, we go high. And do you ever have any regrets that you maybe didn't go?
Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, Tommy, and say, you know, way back there in 1990, maybe we should have gone low too.
But, but what would that have been?
I don't know what that would have been. I wouldn't want to say on this podcast what it would have been.
I just
I would have said something about when are we going to grow up? When are we going to learn? When are we going to get to the point where we won't allow that kind of divisiveness to hold us back?
Right.
When are you gonna get past that? But, you know, that was just not the thing to do at that time.
Did you ever have just a sit down conversation with Jesse Helms?
No. That's the big surprise that a lot of people have had. Once or twice we thought we'd get a chance when our campaign trails crossed, when he might have been somewhere at 2 o'clock and I was coming at 3 o'clock to the same town, that maybe we could decide to accidentally meet and shake hands and talk about the race and make it an impromptu thing. Because as you recall, Jesse never debated me,
right?
Which we were itching to do. We wanted the opportunity to have him talk to North Carolinians with me hearing and him hearing me talk and debating back and forth. And that just never occurred. But, you know, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that now.
But you didn't talk to him after it was all over?
Never. The only time I shook Jesse Helms' hand was as mayor of Charlotte when we went to Washington years before I ever thought about the race. And it might have been just before the Jim Hunt race with Jesse in 84 occurred. I was a part of a delegation that took the council to Washington, and it's, you know, you meet your legislators, you go say hello to the senator, et cetera. And I did that at that time. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know I was the guy that he praised for going to Clemson and so forth and so on.
Did you say, I mean, you
just simply said,
just in the line.
Hello, Mr. Helms. Hello, Mr. Mayor. Yeah. Kept on moving.
Yeah. So you brought up that maybe in 99 or something you could have said, you know, when are we going to get over all this? So it's 2017. It doesn't feel like we've gotten over all this yet. What do you feel like? How do you sense the state, the country, how things are now?
Let me tell you something, and this just occurred to me in this discussion. Race relations is not nearly as bad as it was back in the times that I was growing up. That's a surprising statement to make, but it is true on every measure that you can do it. But I suggest that we are at an inflection point in this moving ahead in this country. First of all, you're never going to be able to take it back. When I hear that term, you know, let's make our country great again, the again part is the part that really is frightening in a sense. What does he mean by again? Well, again means the era that I described to you growing up in a segregated South, the racism that was much more blatant because it was put there by law. The power and growth of minorities in this country suggests that we can never take it back. But there might always be a pause in where we're going before we start to move forward again. I suggest that that's where we are today. The divisiveness, the appeal of this president to secure his base by using race and all the other stuff he's done, the incompetence shown by the way they manage what they're doing, all suggests that maybe it is a great time for America to take a look at what we're doing and where we are. I see that happening. I see that happening with Republicans across the whole spectrum. They're caught in a very strange vice. I see Democrats themselves not quite knowing how we should move forward. It's on both sides. So it's flattened out. It was doing this. It's flattened out. My parents never thought they'd see an African-American president. I mean, they thought this was some craziness. How could this have happened before they died? Well, it turns out that Obama's presidency produced Donald Trump, in my opinion, because it created that same thing called fear on the part of a huge number of people in this country, enough to electoral college-wise elect him as president, okay? But if anybody believes that we're going to return to some other time, they're wrong. So there's going to be conflict. There's going to be Black Lives Matter against whoever else is out there. There are going to be all kinds of folks rising up. But at the end of the day, my faith is in America.
One reason for hope in these hard times is that our country is surely producing some new Harvey Gantz. They might not do things the same way he did, but their goals are the same: to make this country live up to its promises of equality and justice for its Black citizens. There have always been white people who fight against that equality and justice because they want to preserve their power and privilege. No matter how many times they win, they're on the losing side. In these days and weeks after the death of George Floyd, I think more people than ever can see that now. Harvey Gantt didn't win all his political races, and he didn't win his two major battles against Jesse Helms. But in every other way that matters, he beat him. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.